Okay, let's just all admit right up front, this is going to be uncomfortable. Or at least I'm going to admit that this is an uncomfortable topic. And I think that's because we don't talk about it in church. And I know that there might be some younger people present, so I'm going to keep this as PG as I can. But come on, we're talking about sex. More accurately, we're talking about the emotional and spiritual aspects of a physical act. When I was growing up, I got all the usual birds and bees lectures, which was weird and awkward because I don't think back in the day the boys and the girls were taught separately. And I think it was more a matter of, okay, how fast can we get through this? But outside of those one or two days in health class, I don't remember ever talking about sex, and it never, ever came up in church. So today we're continuing our sermon series on the seven deadly sins, and Pastor Beth drew the lust card. Well, isn't that special? So the only way we're going to get through this is to get comfortable with lust and say the church lady has left the building. I didn't know that the church lady had a name. It wasn't until I looked it up, Enid Strict. I didn't realize she had a name. It was just the church lady. But I'm going to get comfortable with this, and we're going to erase the stigma of talking about human sexuality in church. Because here's the headline. God created us as sexual beings. Sexual desire is part of who we are. It's a gift. It's natural. And it's not meant to be squelched or pretend that it doesn't exist. It's meant to express our full humanness. And it's meant to be expressed in a way that enhances our relationships with God and with each other. Religion has often vilified sexual desires as wrong, but we can't tell the difference between healthy and unhealthy, between right and wrong, if we don't fully understand how a virtue becomes a vice. These things that we call the seven deadly sins are good gifts from God that have been manipulated and twisted. People forget about the spiritual elements of these gifts. When we start using the gifts themselves to try and fill spiritual and emotional vacancies, it becomes about self-gratification, not the sharing of a gift or the sharing of our humanness with somebody else. In our scripture today, Paul writes to Timothy, who's the new leader of the church at Ephesus. Paul's been imprisoned in Rome and is nearing death. It's his second letter of instruction and encouragement to Timothy. We know from scripture that Timothy is young, and Paul considers him to be his son in ministry. Among the advice that Timothy receives, remember them of this and warn them before God that they are to avoid wrangling over words, which does no good, but only ruins those who are listening. Do your best to present yourself to God as one approved by him, a worker who has no need to be ashamed, rightly explaining the word of truth. Avoid profane chatter, for it will lead people into more and more impiety. Then Paul comes to this admonition, shun youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. In some versions of this scripture, it says to flee the evil desires of youth or run from anything that stimulates youthful lusts. It sounds like Paul assumes that lusts are confined to the young, but that's a discussion for another time. Paul encourages Timothy to pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace as antidotes to the temptation of youthful lust. Behave yourself, Timothy, and don't fall in with a bad crowd. He encourages him to keep company with people who pursue righteousness just as he does. The implication is that using and following graces, including holy love, will derail impure thoughts and temptations. Paul addresses lust in his letters not only to Timothy, but also to the Ephesians and the Romans. And way back in the Old Testament, in the book of Numbers, the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to add fringe to the corners of their garments and add a blue cord to each fringe. It will be a reminder to follow the commandments and not the lust in your own heart and your own eyes. Concerns about lust have been around for a long time. And no doubt Paul had not only studied the scriptures, but also learned from Jesus about loving God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself. It means putting God first and treating people you meet with holy love and kindness and respect. But then there's the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs. It's one long colloquy or conversation between the bridegroom and the bride, and even the bridal party gets a say here and there. It's a gushing love letter of admiration and attraction and devotion. The bride and the bridegroom pour forth their love for each other in passages like, my beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. And this, his speech is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Solomon, in this writing, is quite colorful. Desires were celebrated, but in the context of a loving relationship. And on the surface, this is a poetic conversation between two people who are in love and betrothed to each other. Betrothal was a big deal in Israel. It was almost as important as the wedding itself. And a couple was essentially married once they became betrothed or engaged. But there's more to this story than meets the eye. It's also a song about Christ and his beloved, the church. There's love, a covenant, a necessary absence or time apart between the bride and the groom, and then the couple being reunited in love. For God loved the world so much that God sent Jesus to walk with us and to experience life with us and to spend his whole life with us, committed to saving us and bringing us to his Father's house. Jesus poured out a new covenant, which we accepted, and then he left us to prepare a place for us where we'll join him for eternity. We live in love and honor for him. He loved us so much that he died for us. Holy love between two people committed to each other is a treasure. It includes the gifts of companionship and support and love and joy. And it includes sexual desires. We were created as sexual beings. It is a gift from God. It's a natural and beautiful way for two people to give the gift of themselves to one another. Sexual desire is also powerful. We underestimate sometimes just how powerful it can be. When it morphs into lust, it has the potential for harm. The right view of the good gift of sexuality avoids degrading sexual pleasure into something meaningless or making it into a base instinct with no emotion. But it also avoids elevating sexual pleasure into something so important and so spiritual that we disconnect from the knowledge that there are human beings involved with the potential for hurt as well as love. So how does a virtue, a gift, become a vice or a burden? Vices can only be understood as deviations from the good of virtue. They're distorted and excessive attachments to good things. Virtue turns into a vice when our pursuit of good things like justice, honor, approval, food, and true intimacy get twisted. We try to make them fill the vacancies in our hearts, and our spirits, but really only God can fill them. We begin to define our happiness in terms of them, rather than seeing them as gifts from God. We might think if food and money and sex and alterations to our physical appearance are not helping us feel better, maybe we're not doing it right. Maybe we need more of them, or we need to pursue them harder. Last week, Pastor Doug preached about gluttony, where food becomes a vice. We're given edible, drinkable gifts from God, but rather than appreciating the flavors and the miracles that they embody and enjoying them in modest portions, we use food to help us feel better, to fill a spiritual or emotional hole that we really need to give over to God. I have wrestled with emotional eating. For many years, I was unaware that I was doing it. Occasionally, I would eat to the point of nausea. When I'm sad, I gravitate towards sweet things. When I'm angry, I want something salty and or crunchy, so no tortilla chip is safe. When I was somewhere in my 20s, I ate almost an entire 9x13 cake in one sitting. I was grieving. I was sad. But that was also the first day I became aware of what I was doing, and I realized that there were better ways to handle my feelings and the gaps in my spirit rather than try to spackle over them with frosting. And at that point in my life, I was pretty distant from God. And while I didn't realize that what I needed was a stronger spiritual connection, I did realize that eating everything in sight was not a solution, and that healing pain with sugar wasn't going to work. It took a long time to reclaim the virtue of appreciating good, healthy, home-cooked foods, or better still, a tomato right off the vine in the summer, or a plum right off of the tree. And it took time to stand up to the vice of gluttony. And I'm not perfect. My crutch on a bad day is still a plate of nachos. But when the vice shows up, I recognize it, and I can name it, and I can deal with it with God's help. American author, theologian, and Presbyterian minister Frederick Buechner had a book called Wishful Thinking, and in that book he wrote, "Food without nourishment doesn't fill the bill for long, and neither does sex without humanness." Physical pleasures, including sexual desires, require that they not be used to satisfy spiritual needs. We are created as sexual beings, but when someone takes that gift and uses it for self-gratification, there can be a lot of collateral damage. That self-gratification can be divorced from other things that make us human, such as the need for love and for trust and for true intimacy, which is not just physical, but emotional and spiritual as well. Not only is the person who wrestles with the vice of lust hurting themselves by perpetuating emptiness that can't be filled, they may be hurting their sexual partner, who may feel quite differently. What if their partner's coming from a place of trust and close connection, only to find out the feelings are not mutual? Or what if the relationship is adulterous? What if one of those people is married? There are multiple spiritual and emotional black holes involved, and there's no joy and no fulfillment. When we examine the deadly sins, when we look closely at these vices, it boils down to excess. Lust and gluttony, for example, reduce pleasure, something good and something beautiful, to simple self-gratification, which is short-lived and leads to a continuous pursuit of fulfillment. Self-gratification is all about individual physical needs, not about commitment to partnership and love. These vices are like black holes in space. The gravitational pull is relentless, and nothing can escape from them, not even light. So we can try to feed these vices whatever they're craving, food, money, sex, recognition, anything, but they'll just demand more. Our self-worth will decline, and in the case of lust, there's a risk of taking others into that black hole with us. Lust is not the same as love. In fact, love is nowhere in the equation when lust takes over. Not love for self, not love for another person, not love for God. It's all about a quick fix. If you're someone who struggles with this particular vice, there is a God of infinite grace who wants to help you fill the gaps in your life, whether they're emotional or spiritual. God, the giver of gifts and creator of the most beautiful aspects of our humanness, wants to mend your brokenness. Lust could be identified as a heart problem. It's a problem of emotional and spiritual emptiness. The gift of sexual pleasure becomes detached from a balanced relationship between two people who are giving themselves to one another. Going all in for love requires risk and authenticity and vulnerability. When sexual desires come into play in a relationship, two people are saying to one another, "I trust you. You can trust me. I appreciate that we're giving ourselves to each other. I appreciate that we are created to be together this way, and I will not take advantage of it. I don't expect you to be perfect. I love you just the way you are." When Jesus came seeking the church as his bride, he didn't come seeking perfect people. He expected us to be imperfect, and that was just fine. He loves us and wants to make us whole again. The church is a collection of broken people trying to fill black holes, but we're still Christ's beloved. Several years ago, a group of Christian musicians known as 10th Avenue North released a song called Beloved. It's a love letter, a song of songs from Christ to us. Here's a little piece of it. Christ takes the worst parts of ourselves without question, and through love can turn vices back into virtues.